Okay, Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order. Today we're going to have a couple of issues. Senate Bill 1011 will be first, and then we're going to have an informational report, update on child welfare and critical incident response team. So we'll start with Senate Bill 1011, and everybody in that row, come on up. Okay, Sean, Paul, and Catherine. Katie, you can stay there. Okay. Okay. I guess we will call it a work session, although we're not going to work the product. But anyway, there is a work session open. And we had a really interesting discussion the last time we met, and I was a little bit concerned that even though you had some authority to gather information, that you weren't necessarily doing it, and I viewed this bill as a direction that we would have the department move in. This is a sausage-making process, and I want it to come out really good. Somebody said it would be quiche instead of sausage. So, okay, so let me say what I would like to do, and I think I've already talked with you. I don't think we need a bill. And the reason we don't need a bill is because you are doing and have the authority to do the things that the bill would have directed you to do. We're going to talk about perhaps a work group that would bring all of the people together, all of the stakeholders, to get suggestions about what they feel comfortable with doing. The end result that I think is really important is that it would give you the information you need that you are looking for, and it would be an opportunity to encourage people to have flu shots and so on. We're not, you know, it can't be a condition of employment. That's the statute forbids that, but we have to have people make some decisions, and they have to be offered, which they may not be doing right now. We may think they're being offered, but they may not. And they want to have a chance to refuse. And we're not going to question why they refuse, but it's an opportunity to do some major education and gather information. And in the meantime, we can find out maybe what other states are doing. We can contact the CDC to find out what they recommend. And this is an ever-changing issue, and when I first introduced this bill last time, I started out by saying, when the pandemic hits, we need to be prepared. Well, it's around the corner. It's like the big earthquake off of the Oregon coast. It's a certainty. There will be a pandemic, and we need to be as prepared as possible, and this is an opportunity to address that. So, let's talk about what you guys are going to do.
Yes, sir. Chair Morissette and committee, thank you very much. My name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health in the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority, and the immunization program is in my office. We really appreciate the direction of moving forward in terms of doing some interim work with a committee, and the Public Health Division will be very pleased to do that. We do want to clarify, we did talk with our Assistant Attorney General in terms of reviewing the different statutes that we do have on the book. It is clear the authority that public health has in the case of an emergency. It is less clear, arguably, in terms of a day-to-day basis and the scope by which our ability would be to actually make this kind of an expectation, all the way down to employers who might employ only 25. So we have some work to do and some questions to do further about looking about the issue of authority. We do want to reiterate that this really, the original bill and what was really important to us was really about a broader concept of declination, a broader concept of vaccination, and the yearly issue that we are trying to deal with around flu. We are well aware of concerns around a larger pandemic, but on an annual basis right now, flu is really what we're trying to address, the death rates around that, the spread of that, and how that can be handled better. I think what I'll do is next refer to Mr. Coleman. And you can speak to the current data that we're collecting.
Chair Morsett, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Deputy Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research. I think as a piece of what this bill was intending to do was collect some information about what healthcare facilities were currently doing. And so we had conversations about what OHPR is doing inside our healthcare acquired infections reporting program. So we are currently in the process for hospitals and nursing homes to start understanding through survey work what kind of vaccinations either they're offering or what percentages of their staff are vaccinated and what the reasons are for not getting vaccinated. So we're sort of in the beginning stages of understanding that information, and I think it feeds really nicely into the workgroup concept for in a couple of months or however long it'll be, when we do get some information to help inform public health process and a larger process to come forward with recommendations about the who, the what, and the how. So that's sort of where we are, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, any detailed questions you might have about that.
Okay, questions?
Can I ask a question? Thank you. While you're in the process of talking about vaccines for influenza, has there been any thought of the same kind of research that has it deals with pneumonia?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, not as part of our healthcare acquired infections reporting program. That is sort of one of the things that have been on our list of things. We thought that flu was sort of the first one to start with. So we'll look in that for you and get back to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, now infectious disease we're not dealing with, right?
Chair Morissette, correct.
Okay, but that's a whole broad field in itself, which needs to be looked at, I guess.
I'm shaking my head.
Okay. Well, yeah, but this has specifically to do with the flu vaccine.
Correct.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Okay. Dr. Cieslak.
Hi. Thanks, Chair Morsett, members of the committee. Once again, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cieslak. I manage the communicable disease section with the Public Health Division and serve as medical director for the immunization program. I just wanted to clarify that our support of the bill, I think, is different from what the Office of Health Policy and Research has set up. The bill that was passed that authorized their regulations was a consumer safety, consumer information bill designed to give consumers information about which hospitals they should choose. It was sponsored by Representative Greenlick. But this bill, I think, is a patient safety bill less than a consumer information bill, or more than a consumer information bill. And I just want to make it clear that our concern is this. There's ample evidence that every year flu sweeps through, that healthcare providers are at risk for getting flu, that healthcare providers work while they have the flu, and they're at risk of spreading it to patients, often who are at the most risk of complications from influenza. It's qualitatively different from our concerns about many other vaccinations where we recommend them or even require them for school children, insofar as our primary concern is protecting the people that they might spread it to. The people who are at most at risk of flu, elderly and immunocompromised people, don't respond as well to the flu vaccine. And sometimes the best way to protect them is by protecting the people who have contact with them. It's been shown in studies of nursing homes, for example, that you can better protect the patients by vaccinating the staff in randomized trials than you can by vaccinating the patients. So, you know, concerns about, the individual liberties of healthcare providers are serious, but there is this lingering question of, when does that have to yield to concern about the patients they're taking care of? Thank you.
Well, and I guess the watchword that I've used is do no harm. And we want to be sure when people go to the hospital that that's, you know, they're protected. And it is a patient safety issue, for sure.
I'm sorry, but you'll have to wait until next time.
I told her we were going to call this a Telfer bill. And she was excited.
Well, the sock vaccine has become a common word. I thought Telfer vaccine.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The good doctor just set off an alarm in my head because he talked about the elderly and nursing homes, and, you know, we talk about do no harm. Aren't more deaths due to pneumonia than influenza?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, you know, typically it's hard to tell the two apart. A lot of pneumonia, a disproportionate share of pneumonia, happens during influenza season. And when the, you know, when the bean counters, if you will, or the body counters are looking at causes of death, they tend to lump the two together, pneumonia and influenza. It's pretty clear that influenza puts you at risk for bacterial pneumonia, and a lot of it is associated. It's hard to tease out the differences between the two. But your intuition, your intimation is correct. Typically, the same people who need the influenza vaccine need the pneumococcal vaccine. But pneumococcal disease is not spread from person to person the way influenza is.
Okay, other questions, comments? Okay,
thank you very much. Wait a minute. When we schedule our meetings for the interim, then we will revisit the issue, and when you come up with a plan to do some kind of a work group, I think that's really good, because there may be some employers that are not licensed, maybe, that you license, that need to come under this, that have hands-on dealings with patients and so on. Do you deal with ambulance companies?
Chair Morissette, yes, we do through the healthcare licensing division.
Yeah.
So what we'd be able to do is look at a broad spectrum, I think, of who the different provider groups are that we'd like to have. We also think it's important that we have the voice of the consumer at the table as well, and so we'll be looking at it as a patient safety and a consumer aspect as well.
Okay, I guess my question refers to a comment that was made earlier that not all of the people who deal with patients are licensed by your group, and should there be some groups that we also... Now, what's an example of that?
Chair Morissette, I guess one that comes to mind very easily in the long-term care setting is our certified and CNAs.
The CNAs, okay. Yeah.
But I think that if that's one of the concerns that you have, we will take that into consideration and look at those groups and representation.
Well, I think the idea is that people who have hands-on dealings with patients, now I know the custodians and hospital rooms come close to that, but the CNAs definitely do have the hands-on. They
mm-hmm.
should be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if everyone who works in the... I guess you have to draw the line somewhere, but the ones that you either license or should be licensed should be involved.
And Chair Morissette, we actually do have a temporary definition that we've been using from the CDC that kind of identifies typical groups that usually are involved in direct patient care. I don't have it with me at the moment, but we can communicate that back to the committee as an example of the kind of categories we'd be looking at.
Then the other thing we talked about earlier is not only contacting the CDC, but to find out what other states are doing. Washington has a bill. Whether or not it passes, I don't know. But just what's going on around the country and what the CDC's involvement is. So.
Great.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. The next, we'll close the public hearing on... Senate Bill 1011, and we will open an information hearing. Aaron Kelly Seal and Lois Day, would you come up, please? Update on child welfare and critical incident response team. I've had one direct experience when I... In the 1990s, I was Mayor Springfield, and a young three-year-old child, Teslin O'Cull, was murdered by her mother's boyfriend. My wife and I actually sat through parts of the trial and the penalty part of it as well, and it was interesting. The Springfield police said, well, yeah, they were called about something going on, but when they got there, they saw Tessalyn sitting on the floor, and she seemed to be okay, and they thought that the call was because the woman was being abused. And she was the police were assured that, no, everything is fine. And then DHS said, or the Children Services Children said, well, that's under the radar screen. That's too low in the priority list. And then as a result of that, or about that time, is when the safety net program was set up that was to deal with incidents that didn't warrant the Services to Children and Family, the caseworker, to go out. And so I asked about that the other day, and they said, well, that's gone by the wayside. Now, the other incident in Lane County, which prompts my concern, is the 16-year-old girl who died as a result of abuse. And there again, apparently, it did not rise to the level of concern with the agency. Now, I'm not pointing fingers at the agency. I'm just concerned that we don't have a safety net in place, that somebody could go out there who was in just to check things out and find out if there's more to it than meets the eye, because there's an overload work for the agency. I can understand that. So I just want to have a report, you know, just on what's going on and what your plans are and what your concerns are and whether or not we have enough money to continue doing the good thing with the good work that we're doing. I'm concerned about what's going to happen next biennium and with the cuts and so on if we don't bring in more revenue. So who wants to start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I am the director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. And with me today is Lois Day. She's the administrator of our Office for Office of Safety and Permanency for Children, which represents really the child welfare program area. In the Children, Adults, and Families Division within the Department of Human Services, I have responsibility for child welfare services, self-sufficiency services like temporary assistance for needy families or supported child care for employed low-income employed parents, and also for vocational rehabilitation services serving adults with disabilities to become employed. I want to first just start out by thanking you for your interest in our most vulnerable children and their families, and for the opportunity today to provide some perspective on the work that we do and more globally, and then we will speak specifically to the more recent case that, Senator, you were referencing in Lane County. Yesterday, we made the same presentation, and I apologize. It doesn't appear that my computer skills have improved since then. So I think you have in front of you the PowerPoint, and I know we handed it out, and we'll let the technical difficulties resolve themselves. It's in front of me here, so there's something going on that I'm sure Debbie is working on. In our child welfare system, as you pointed out, really across the continuum, the way that we approach this work, I think in Oregon, rightly so, is along a continuum of child safety. And it's important to keep in mind that the child welfare system that we're focusing on today really is at that far end of the continuum, and our authority to intervene in a family's life really begins when a child has already been hurt or is imminently in danger of being hurt. And so there's a whole spectrum prior to that of prevention and early intervention that has, over the years, become less and less resourced in terms of capacity. And it's ranging from things like mental health and addiction treatment for parents, early intervention through Healthy Start and Relief Nurseries. Those programs are in our Commission on Children and Families, or even our TANF program, our family support program that works works on both issues around employment for the family, economic stability, but also on child safety. So those services ultimately prevent the need for a child welfare intervention and have been proven to do that. When child welfare is needed, we provide two different kinds of services. We serve families in their homes, and then when that cannot happen in a way that is safe for the child, we remove children from their homes and bring them into foster care under the state's custody. That is an extraordinary intervention, and we take our responsibility around that authority very seriously, and we recognize how intrusive that can be for a child and their family. And that is why the issue of safety and protection really drives our system and our authority. We do have limited capacity in terms of our ability to serve children and their families in their own homes. And this has been something that I've spoken with probably each of you about at some point. But it really is significant, I think, for our system when the resources that support children safely with their parents are fewer than what is needed. Because what that means ultimately is if we can't keep a child safe in their own home, the only choice that we have in terms of safety as a system is to take them out of that home and place them with a relative, hopefully, first and foremost, if we are able to do that, and then if not that, within, in foster care with someone they don't know. And in terms of resources, as you mentioned, Senator, the capacity of the system, not just in child welfare, but the courts, the attorneys that represent parents and children, the CASA program that represent the best interests of children, very under-resourced services for parents and for their children, and all of those policy changes and resource issues affect our ability to provide this very critical service. I wanted to just give you some perspective on our services in child welfare last year. We received about 67,885, well, exactly that many reports of abuse and neglect in 2009. We referred for investigation 28,584 of those reports, and we confirmed that there were unduplicated 11,090 children in Oregon last year that were victims of abuse and neglect. There are approximately 870,000 children in the state of Oregon, and there were 13,291 of those children. That represents about 1.5% of our children here in Oregon spent at least one day in foster care last year. On any given day, we have about 8,460 children that we're responsible for. Most of our children go home to their parents. That's something that I'm not sure the public generally often appreciates, but almost 60% of the children that we serve go home. And if they don't go home, our charge is to find another permanent placement for them as soon as we possibly can, while giving the time that their parents need to address the safety issues that resulted in the children coming into our care in the first place. The largest single driver of abuse and neglect in the state is addiction. And second to that is domestic violence. So we keep track, and they're not mutually exclusive, but we keep track of the stressors that we see when we intervene in a family's life in response to a call of abuse or neglect. And those are the two most significant and most frequently, the ones that we see most frequently. We have been talking about in the state and will continue to be talking about, and I'll talk more later about our strategies. Unfortunately, in Oregon, our African American and Native American children are overrepresented in our foster care system. So we've been paying very close attention along the continuum from the time we receive a call to the time we find permanency for a child to the issues around race and ethnicity and how we're serving families. And we're working on ways to strengthen our work in that area. As you know, we do serve young people and teens, and sometimes when we're not able to find a permanent arrangement for them and they end up aging out of the foster care system, it's our hope that we always can provide them with some services to help them transition to adulthood. We were able to do that for almost 1,600 children last year, young people, in terms of independent living services. And again, to that issue of resources, that number, the number that we were able to serve represents the resources that we have to serve those youth are fewer than the youth who need the services. Because our system is subject to many demands and pressures in terms of things that happen to children and their families and our need to respond to those things, we've been really making a very deliberate effort to focus our energy and strategies around some areas that we know can make the biggest difference in terms of our work on behalf of children and families. So we have created a strategic plan for child welfare that looks at specific areas for improvement, and there are two overarching goals that we have. The first is that we would safely and equitably reduce the number of children in this state who experience foster care. We, as in Oregon, we place, and this is a placement rate, it's not a foster care rate, but a placement rate, we place more children in foster care than many other states do. We're one of the highest placement rate states in the country. And that's something that we have been looking at very closely, and as we've looked more closely at our data and this first strategy around increasing the number of children who remain safely at home, it turns out that a little bit over 20% of children who come into the Oregon foster care system, so they've experienced then the trauma of removal from a parent, go back home to that parent within about 3 months. And that tells us, I think, that if we could shore up the in-home service delivery portion of our service and serve parents and children better on the front end, hopefully for some of those children that are removed and then go home relatively quickly. I mean, 3 months for a child is a very, very long time. But in terms of experience in our system, it's an interesting marker to have that many children going home that quickly. It tells us we have some room to improve in terms of the number of children we bring into care if we can safely serve them at home before they need to come into care.
Now, you mentioned that Oregon has one of the highest rates?
Placement rates into foster care.
Okay, that could be for one of two reasons. We have a better record keeping. We take care of people better, so therefore we identify more people who need help. Or there's something going on in Oregon that is detrimental to children at risk. I don't know if it's. I like to think that we're doing a better job, and therefore we have a higher rate because we're doing a better job, and other states are letting people fall through the cracks. Which is it?
Mr. Chair, I think there's also a third reason, which could be that we don't have enough service on the front end that would allow us to feel comfortable as an organization leaving a child safely at home with their family, which means then they come into care. And I think there are other states, quite frankly, who have more resources and services that enable then their foster care system to say, you know, we're actually pretty comfortable if we can put a structure of safety around a child and their family. Taking a risk, and it is a risk for the child welfare system to do this, when we know that a child's been hurt or we have concern about a family and we make the decision that we can put in place enough safety support for that child and that family to leave them in their home setting. But I think it's probably a combination of a lot of those different things, and I just wanted to put that third driver on the table as well.
And Mr. Chair, one of the other pieces, and it's only been the last few sessions that we've actually, you know, began the process of talking about wraparound services to families, and particularly talking about alcohol and drug treatments and some of those. And we know that, and I'm sure that Erin can verify that, when she talked about a part of the causal problem is drugs and alcohol and domestic violence. And so when you take into those factors, and the more you delay in providing those services on the front end, the more apt we are to keep individuals into our system a lot longer. So those are also factors that are involved. And we just, what was it, a few sessions began to get very serious from a funding standpoint, of talking about providing the dollars that are necessary for some of the treatments and wraparound services that the agency has asked for years.
One, my wife and I visited the birthing center at Sacred Heart Hospital in the middle of Eugene, not the new one, a couple of years ago, and there was a little... they had an incubator there. We looked at the incubators, which are... We lost some children prematurely because the incubators weren't adequate at the time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we're really interested in that. And there was one little baby with a little hat on, a wool hat to keep its head warm. But anyway, and they said, well, this baby is waiting for, you know, it'll be released pretty soon, but the mother is on Healthy Start, and she's being prepared to be able to care for this child because her parents don't have the skills to care for children. And so that left a lasting impression, because that's really neat that, okay, I don't know where Healthy Start is. That's the other problem, because that is the first program that I think addresses the adequacy of parenting. And it's just a generational thing. And a woman came to the drug court one time. A woman came to our committee who graduated from the drug court, and she was a counselor, and she said, this is the first time we've broken the generational drug addiction, because my grandparents, my parents, and I use drugs in front of all our kids. Oh, well, we don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. So we do have some programs, but they're underfunded.
You know, Mr. Chair, you brought up an interesting one, because you brought up parenting. And this sitting legislator has been trying to get us to talk parenting classes in high school. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we wait until after the individual has already given birth.
Some schools have, our school at Springfield High School did some of that, but mostly it was because there were so many pregnant women there in high school, so they started doing parenting classes. We missed a step at the front end of that.
Because we don't come here with a roadmap.
I know.
Excuse me.
Okay. Go ahead.
On this slide, you can see the other goals that we have and that are associated with the overarching effort we're making to safely and equitably reduce children who experience foster care, elimination of disparate treatment and the overrepresentation of children of color in foster care. I talked earlier, on an earlier slide, you saw the numbers in terms of percentages, and as I mentioned, both Native American and African American children are overrepresented in our system as compared to the percentage of children they represent generally in Oregon. We're working on increasing placements and connections with family, siblings, relatives, and other individuals that children know. One of the ways that we really appreciate can mean better outcomes for children, both in terms of safety and their well-being, and all of the indicators that go along with it, is when we can keep them connected to their biological families or people that are known well to them. We also are looking, there is a need for foster care in the state, and we're looking at how we can improve our efforts to more timely reunite children with their families or with another permanent outcome so that the time they spend in foster care is shorter. And we're doing all of this under a very close watch on the issue of safety, and I really want to underscore that this goal is not driven by resources or the economy. What this is driven by is our belief about what's best for children and families and how our system serves them. And we will never focus on an outcome that's associated or listed here at the expense of the issue of safety for a child. And so we've been monitoring very closely what we call our reabuse rate, which is how often is it that we know of a child who's been hurt, who gets hurt again. And in fact, that rate has been declining just at the same time that our rate of children in foster care overall has been declining. And so what that's telling us is that fewer children are in foster care and fewer children, and actually children are safer. The second area where we are focusing our strategic efforts is around the services that we provide to children who do need foster care and who are in our system. And the way we talk about this goal is just to say that children in foster care are safe and healthy. And for us, this is a focus on strategies that look at timely and appropriately meeting the mental health needs of kids. There's been conversation already at the table around wraparound, and I know you all remember passing a bill last session about this initiative, which child welfare is at the forefront of implementing right now. We're also looking at making sure that we encourage placement stability, and we do that through relatives, culturally and linguistically specific services as some of our primary strategies there, and eliminating abuse in foster care is one of our main goals.
Okay. I remember the wraparound discussion, and there was some discussion of whether or not there were redundancies, if, you know, coming together, is that How's it working out, the wraparound that we're doing?
We're about to, we just solicited for pilot sites, and we had 7 proposals that represent, I believe, I hope I get this number correct, 25 of the 36 Oregon counties. It may be 28, but I think it's 25. And so we're going through a selection process. And really, if you recall, in large part what this is about the state working to reduce barriers for local mm-hmm. collaboration on behalf of children and their families. And so there are many localities that already do wraparound, provide system of care, wraparound services. It goes sometimes by different names. And this is about us as a state helping to support those efforts, asking for permission from our federal partners so that we can have more flexibility. And we're not quite at that point yet, but we're getting close, and we'd be happy to come back and provide you an update soon.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because we did pass this bill last time, and we had a lot of discussion about it and the merits of it and so on. So that's good to know that you're making progress.
Our first phase, we're focusing our first phase on children in foster care specifically, and specifically those kids who are the highest in need of service. And there is hope that we would have some resource to reinvest in serving them differently, more flexibly, in a less restrictive setting. And that's ultimately the goal. And beyond children in foster care, I know you and I have talked about this. We believe this model is relevant to all kids in Oregon. Look forward to that. So are we getting results? Are the strategic efforts we're making actually paying off? After, you know, in 2007, late that year, the federal government came out and they did a review of our system, and it found that the system was not passing in all of the federal measures that were identified. I should mention that that's true for every state in the country. No state has passed the federal review. The bar is set very high, as it should be, for children in the system. But in response to that, what follows from a review like that is an improvement plan. And we measure, of course, our progress on that plan. And as I mentioned earlier, the reoccurrence of abuse is down. Fewer children in foster care are being abused or neglected. More children are returning sooner and safely to their parents. More children who are free to be adopted are being adopted sooner. And we're making some strides in terms of finding permanency for children who've been in foster care for long periods of time. We have already passed 5 of our 6 federal measures in the first 3 quarters of our improvement plan. And the one where we're continuing to work and already seeing improvement but haven't quite met the goal is around stability of foster care placement. We have other measures which I would like to mention are on the internet. We do a dashboard for our program by district, so if you're interested in how your local county or district is doing in terms of its performance in child welfare, you can on the internet access, we call them our dashboards for child welfare, and you can see how we're doing in terms of things like referring children in a timely way to mental health placements, seeing children in the required 30-day period every month, face-to-face contact, responding to reports of abuse and neglect. It's all there. The critical incident response team is an effort that is put in motion, a process that is put in motion within our program when things go wrong, when we have a serious outcome, serious injury or fatality usually for a child. And so I want to shift gears now from the bigger picture to this picture in terms of what it is that we do, what we are doing to be accountable and transparent in terms of things that are going wrong for children who we know in the child welfare system. This started in 2004 under Governor Kulongoski's leadership, and the legislature recognized this process in statute in 2007 through a bill regarding Carley's Law. The purpose of this is to really focus in on learning lessons quickly and improving the agency's work on behalf of the children that we serve. There are certain criteria. So the responsibility for calling what we call a CERT, a critical incident response, lies with Dr. Goldberg, the director of the department. In some cases, CERTs are mandatory, and that is true when there is a child fatality that is likely the result of abuse or neglect, and the child is either in our custody or we've had a call about that child within the previous year. And we also then, the director also then has discretion, and this is an error in my PowerPoint, I apologize for that, has discretion really at any time that he would like to call a cert, he may. But most often the likelihood that a cert will be called is higher when there's a child fatality or serious injury, and the child had some history with us as a department. So the issue here is us learning lessons from the past. The certs are unique for Oregon in a couple of ways. One, they're unique in that there are some very strict timelines. We've actually consulted with our national counterparts to find out, you know, how do other states do this work? What do other state child welfare programs do when things go wrong? And have heard back from them that our process is very rigorous in terms of its timelines, but also very transparent, much more so than many others, because we publish our cert reports on the Internet. So we go through a review process. We write a report about what happened in terms of the agency's actions. We identify systemic issues like training, policy, or practice, and then we publish our report on the web. CERT teams are agency staff and external partners, and you can see the number of CERTs that have happened each year since the practice went into effect. You'll see there's a big increase in 2009, and that's deliberately the case. In 2008, there was a CERT review group, which the Department of Justice, many of you may remember Pete Shepard, he chaired at the governor's request, and they strengthened the process looking at both the review itself, the response to the recommendations reviews present, as well as public release of reports. And that group came back and said the department should be calling certs more often. So we're following that recommendation, and you can see there's a very large jump between the 08, the number of certs called in 08 and the number in 09. We had an internal audit in December of 2008 looking at our cert reports, the recommendations they made in our follow-through on them, and it was determined by a group separate from our division but internal to the department that our compliance was at a rate of around 99%. There was only one recommendation that was still outstanding. I wanted to just give you some examples of some systemic issues, and what I'm going to do, if you wouldn't mind, is go from the bottom up, and I'm going to let Lois talk about the one on the top because it's a good segue to the next slide, which is focusing in on the JM cert, the case in Lane County. When I talk about systemic issues, what we try and do through the CERT process is really identify is something that happened in that case happening elsewhere. In other words, was the issue that were some of the challenges that happened that we can identify in hindsight through the CERT process unique to a particular case, or do we think this is a challenge that all of our staff or many of our staff and other communities are facing? So, for example, we had a CERT in which there were parents that were being served by the developmental disability system. And what we learned through that CERT is that our system doesn't have a great working knowledge. We don't have a specific training to the disability system for our child welfare workers. And there was some confusion in the CERT about the roles, the different people who support or represent parents with developmental disabilities play. So sometimes they're advocates, sometimes they're service providers. And our system depends on professionals from other disciplines to inform the work that we do. And so what we did as a result of this identification of an issue was we did some training in collaboration with the DD system for our staff so that they could understand better some of the workings of that system when we're dealing with parents who are part of it. And children is another issue, but that wasn't the issue in this CERT. Domestic violence. I mentioned earlier that that's one of our main drivers in terms of abuse and neglect in this state. And what we have found more than once in a CERT in 2009 is that it is really challenging for us as an organization when we're responding to what ultimately is usually threat of harm. So a child is at imminent danger because of a domestic violence situation with their parents. And we have refined our policy in this area as recently, I believe, as 2008. And what we determined through these certs is that we've got to continue to be very deliberate in our training with staff about what what our response is when domestic violence is present. We also put forward, and I think there has been strong support for a new model of child welfare service delivery where domestic violence advocates from the community are sitting in our offices with our child welfare partner, with our child welfare workers, so that we can intervene differently and have that expertise alongside us, since it is such a significant issue. We haven't gotten funding for that yet, but it's something that we would like to see happen. Communication across big systems where people have different responsibilities is a challenge, and one of the things we found in a couple of reports last summer that involved abuse in foster care is that we have a disconnect in our system when we are talking sometimes about communication between the people who receive reports of abuse and neglect and then the people who certify foster parents. So we, as a result of that cert, there's actually been a foster care safety team that's comprised primarily of external partners. The chair actually is Megan Schultz, who's the CASA director from Lane County, and they've been working on a series of recommendations for us around abuse in foster care more globally, and also this issue of communication across our staff and how that works, where it's working well, and how we can replicate that more consistently across the agency's practice. Working with teen parents is a challenge, and in this cert, the issue was, in a couple of certs, the issue has been that when we respond to a report of abuse and neglect about a child, and that child happens to be the child of a teen parent, we have struggled in response not to, in these certs, the issue was not the issue of response to the child who was the subject of the report, but actually our response to the teen parent. So it's a complicated situation when you have a young person who is parenting a child and that child has a safety risk. And we've determined that we need to do a better job actually also then almost in parallel responding to the safety of the teen parent. So that's been an interesting conversation that we've been having and trying to learn from outside experts about.
Okay, I mentioned earlier that at high school that I taught at, Springfield High School, they did have a teen parent class, and these were teens who brought their children. And do you find, is that common? Do many school districts, have you been working with school districts on teen parents? Because it's the problem, you know, a lot of kids would drop out. A lot of kids, you know, teen parents maybe don't have the kind of support. But to bring their babies, there was a special room, and they did other classes too. But has there been that connection with the school districts? Lois?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Lois Day. I'm the administrator of the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children. We have a similar program in Eugene, which is where I reside.
Oh.
We have not had a direct connect between us and those programs, although we do work with those programs if some of those teams come to the attention of the agency through a report and we're involved with them.
Yeah, good. That's great. Yeah. What school?
Thurston. Oh, excuse me, not Thurston. I'm sorry, Churchill.
Okay.
Churchill has a similar program.
And do they bring their babies?
They do. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they also have some parent training type courses that occur in conjunction with that.
Yeah. I think that is a great, great connection. Now, is this uncommon throughout the state, or are there rare?
I can't speak to that.
Well, I think that's something that we ought to be looking at is to make, you know, connections with the school districts, and whenever possible to have the teen parents involved with their children in a school setting, so they're there and they get parenting along with it. I think that's super. So I think we should be talking to the Department of Ed about that, maybe.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just a comment. At least in the Gresham-Barlow School District, we have a separate building for teen moms, and it's really a local issue on where they want to put their funds, and a lot of parenting is going on. I'm not sure. I know they're mandatory reporters, so the teachers there would definitely be able to report. I'm not sure how the connection would be between the agency and school district.
Yeah, I guess what I was thinking is maybe with the Department of Ed to talk with them about their role in promoting the idea. I mean, obviously it's a local decision, and each school board has to decide and so on, but I think it would be a good thing to take a look at.
Chair Morissette, if I may just, my experience with those programs is they're typically funded out of Head Start, early Head Start resources. And so there is on-site child care that I'm aware of also in the Portland metro area, and that is how those programs get supported through the schools. And I think it gets back to this issue we were talking about earlier, what are we doing very early and often on behalf of and in support of parents, no matter their age, but obviously in particular parents who happen to also be teens.
Now, we just, we have 25, 30 youth come into the room. Selwood Middle School.
Are you here
Portland,
for the
Portland
youth legislature?
No.
No? Okay.
Okay. Anyway, this is very timely because we're looking at children's issues. We're looking at issues of child abuse, foster parenting, teen parenting, and all of that stuff. And trying to get a handle on, which we have a pretty good program, but we're always short of resources, and what we're doing here is getting a report on what's, you know, the agency is doing for in cases of child abuse, and we're just going to get into a situation that occurred in Lane County where a 16-year-old girl died as a result of abuse, and that was one of the rare instances where people kind of fall through the cracks in terms of reporting and so on and so forth. So, onward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, we'll move on to the next slide. We'll talk about the comprehensiveness of our assessments and as we get to this cert, and this was an issue here as well. And so the first cert, unfortunately, of 2010 is involved an abuse-related fatality, as you mentioned, of a 16-year-old girl. And we had a report concerning abuse or neglect regarding this child within the 12 months prior to her death. So that meant that this cert, this critical incident response team, was a mandatory one for us as an organization. This case is a very difficult case on many, many levels. What happened to this child was horrific, and it is a terrible tragedy that our communities, I think statewide, are continuing to grieve, as well as across our organization. The cert review in this case, and we published our first report, our timelines require that the cert first report out on its work, the team report out on its work within 30 days. And one of the things I need to mention is that there is an ongoing criminal investigation in this case, and so when you look at the cert online, you will see that portions of it are blacked out or redacted. And part of the cert process is very inclusive of law enforcement, the district attorney's office, and others who are working on the case in order to coordinate. And in this case, we, because the parents who have been arrested in conjunction with this young woman's death have not yet been tried or prosecuted, we had to be very intentional about our role in supporting the criminal investigation in this case. So that's the reason for the cert looking the way that it does. What we were able to report out on, though, was a reflection on the team's reflection on the work of the agency in this report. And what the team found was that the family from which this that was raising this child was high risk. They had a child welfare history in another state, and unfortunately that history was not adequately considered when we received calls of abuse and neglect about this young woman. We had received information in the past from credible sources that we also did not consider well. And one of the probably most concerning and driving issues in this particular case was that we didn't appropriately evaluate this young woman's capacity to protect herself and report abuse when we were making a decision about whether or not to investigate, and also then I think when we investigated. There are several system issues under review, and this is where I might turn it over to Lois to talk a little bit about the things that the CERT team determined we need to do some more work on and we need to really look out more closely. And part of that work, as I mentioned earlier, is is to evaluate whether something is that happened, whether what we determined happened here is also happening in other cases. And the process is such that we will report out again 30 days from the last report on our progress, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the work we're going to do, but I'm going to ask Lois to speak a little to the systemic issues that we're looking at in this case.
One of the interesting things that you can address, Lois, is that the grandmother who called in a complaint didn't identify herself as a grandmother. From what I remember reading, it was an anonymous tip, and instead of identifying herself, now I don't understand. Why would she do that? I wonder. I mean, did she think that if she identified herself as a grandmother, they would be less likely to pay attention to it? Seems to me it would be the opposite.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I can't really speak to what that particular individual's motivation was. What I can speak in general, though, is to when people do call us, whether or not they report anonymously or identify themselves, the report is given the same level of consideration. So there's lots of reasons, I think, why people may choose not initially or at any time to give us their name when they're reporting concerns about a child. But we want that report nonetheless, and we'll consider it seriously. In speaking about the systems issues that we identified, or at least potential system issues we identified in this particular cert, one of them had to do with the comprehensiveness or completeness of the work we do when we're screening calls before we send someone out into the field to actually visit with the family on a face-to-face basis, and then the sufficiency of the supervisory review of those decisions. The way our system is designed, the way our policy is written, we have social service specialists taking the calls, trained to ask additional questions and try and get a picture of what is the concern that's actually being reported to us, and a determination if it rises to the level that we have the authority to actually go out and knock on someone's door. And then that is reviewed by a supervisor to ensure that more than one set of eyes has a look on it. The CERT team believed there was additional work that could have been done to have a more complete screening of that call that could have caused us to go out in the field. An additional systemic issue was really around the isolation of children. And when we don't have the traditional supports in the community that we might make additional calls to, medical, school, et cetera, are there more questions? Is there a different protocol we should be following for children who are more isolated? A third issue was how we consider a child's age when determining whether or not they're vulnerable to certain situations or their level of vulnerability. There's two places in our system where we look at that in the front end of the system. The first is in the screening. And in screening, the vulnerability determination that we're making is really eliciting enough information from the caller to determine why the caller believes this particular child is vulnerable to the abuse they're alleging. Age is never supposed to be the sole determinant we use when making that particular assessment. But an assessment of a child's actual vulnerability on our part can only be done with face-to-face contact. And it requires a field assessment to determine whether or not a 16-year-old has what the level of vulnerability of any child is, 16 or 3, based on the conditions and circumstances you encounter when you do that face-to-face contact. So what we identified is that we really need to look at whether or not we're appropriately applying our own standard around vulnerability in the screening and in the field decision-making. And the fourth one, excuse me.
While you're talking, it just popped in my head. The experience of the worker who received the call, what level of experience, because that also plays into how you receive the information and how you're able to query the caller.
Mm-hmm.
Was it entry level? Was it mid-level? I mean, was that looked at when you did your review, your CERT review?
With the level of the individual that took the call as a social service specialist, which is our casework level position, I don't believe that the CERT team looked specifically to the years of experience an individual had. We were looking more to whether or not there was an appropriate application of our policy and practice.
Now,
I raise that because, you know, you can take, for example, even with having the social worker too, but had not been online or had not been at the practice for, let's say, 3 months or 4 months, might not have the same level of sophistication or skills as someone who, you know, had been doing this for a year or two. And that's why I asked that question.
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, you're absolutely right. And part of the way our system is designed is that a supervisor reviews that work prior to the final decision being made. And that's a key component of the way we've designed the policy to sort of protect, not so much protect, but take into account that our workforce comes to us at different levels of experience.
So someplace in this, both pieces didn't get all the way through.
There are areas we want to look at to make sure that we have consistent application.
Yeah. The reason that I ask you here is to get your sense of what happened and not to lay blame or anything, because this is a learning experience. I mean, this is I'm sure that there are things that you are going to reevaluate in your, you know, system, a systemic kind of thing. So anyway, go ahead.
Thank you. The final systemic issue that we identified that we wanted to make sure that we looked at further was whether additional calls of reporting abuse or neglect were received by the department, and whether we documented all those we received. And I think this is I'm sorry, I stumbled there.
In this case, because there was such intense public scrutiny of what was going on, and there were many reports being made publicly by people that they had placed calls to the department, we believe we did a very thorough internal investigation very quickly in terms of what we were hearing publicly and then what our own records showed us. We believe that in the CERT report, you will see that we received 4 reports of abuse about this child prior to the report that was reporting the fatality. We believe we've captured every call that we received. We want to be certain that's the case. And so this step is really just to go that extra link that we need to be certain that if we're getting a call about abuse or neglect, that in fact we're documenting it. As I say, we believe that we've done that. We looked through our call records, not just in the county area, but in different parts of the state, looking to make sure that we had documented and that the CERT team was reviewing every call that we received. And we believe we've done that, but we're going to go another couple of steps.
Now, tell me about the safety net program. That doesn't exist anymore.
Chair Morissette, we did in the past have a program called the safety net. We don't have that to the same extent that we did in the past. So I guess I can't speak much more to that. It's not
what did the program do when we had it?
In the past, we had a program where when we received calls that didn't rise to the level that we could make a face-to-face contact in certain communities, we were able to refer those for the potential for a community contact by a community partner.
A community partner...
Yes.
Such as
nonprofits that provide services to families, okay, or other DHS
now,
programs.
Now, Springfield, you were there when Tesla and O'Call.
Yes, sir. I was.
That case, yeah. And we had a work group that spent considerable time after that going over all kinds of things leading up, why wasn't she identified and so on and so forth. And I don't know if the safety net came about because of that or was there before, but it was just something that seemed to make a lot of sense. And I know we did have a nonprofit in Springfield that did serve that purpose and would go out and do that. I think it's really important to have that program, but, again, it's a funding thing. But the partnership is good.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question on the 4 calls that were received by the at least documented that the agency received? do you have identified the workers that received the call? Were they the same ones? Were there different ones? You know, and did your looking at systems, did you look at that particular aspect and where maybe one might have gotten one view and somebody else got another view of the call? And ultimately, supposedly, the supervisor would have been involved in all four of the calls or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, separate from the CERT process, when something like this happens, we initiate a personnel and performance review with respect to the individuals that were involved in a particular case. And in this case, you'll see that the calls that were received over a length of time, two in 2006, one in 2007, and then one report in 2009. And so there are staff that are currently under investigation, that process, that separate investigative process that's looking at whether our policies were followed and whether the individual performance of staff met our expectation in terms of a standard of care for our work, is also underway. It's separate from the CERT process, which is focusing on the larger systemic issues. But it's very true that to some degree they inform one another. So around the training issues or the supervisory issues, those conversations will inform each other's work.
Follow-up question. One of the, and it's been discussed before, and that was the issue of records and record keeping, and sometimes that can be a laborious process for some of the workers. And we talked about, you know, having a Scrivener kind of a process where they could, you know, have a transcriber. I think it was someplace in Texas, if I can remember my history right. Did that play any into this particular case of recording? Was recording an issue at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters. No, but a related issue, or the issue that drove the discussion about SpeakRight, which we have implemented throughout our system, which is a verbal, a way for our workers to verbally and get transcribed their case notes and records while they're on the move, on the go. They can do this work. I think it's important that the issues of workload be acknowledged, and that is the issue that underscores, I think, your question. We are always looking for ways to increase the amount of time that our staff have to spend with clients, children and families, and increase the amount of time that they have for supervision. And increase the amount of time that they have, quite frankly, to think. We ask our staff to make the right decision 100% of the time. And there is a lot at stake in the decisions that they're making. And when you look back, when I said earlier to the 67,000 reports of abuse and neglect that we got in 2009, if I remember correctly, that's about one report every 7 or 8 minutes. We do have workload challenges that our system struggles against. So it's always our obligation, I think, as a management group and as a program team, to be looking for ways to make sure that what we're asking folks to do in terms of an administrative burden is minimized so that they're doing the work they need to do and can focus on the services to children and their families, and that we're freeing up time for people to be able to think, to have thoughtful conversations with supervisors, and to respond to the volume of work that's going on. That also has to do with our staffing levels and many other things, as you well know.
Has there been any? Okay, I'm still hung up on the safety net, and I'm wondering if nonprofits in some communities, including my own, would be willing to partner at their expense with the agency to continue the safety net work. I mean, obviously, under the direction of the agency. I mean, I know it's a funding thing, and I remember in 2005 I was on the on the Ways and Means Subcommittee, and that issue came up, a safety net, and I think it was funded then. I don't know when the funding ended, but if it's a partnership with a community. Now, here we have Catholic Community Services that's doing great work in Marion County. I know they're involved in Lane County, and maybe that's something that I should be looking at, but I'm wondering if the department or the state would be willing to accept a connection with a nonprofit that was willing to do that as part of their mission.
Chair Morissette, I think that your question raises a couple of different issues, and if I don't capture exactly what you're looking for here, please let me know. One of the things that the safety net did was give us permission to share what is otherwise confidential information with another organization about people about whom we've received calls of abuse and neglect. And that information is what the safety net program did was actually create the ability for us when we received a call, and in fact the call did not rise to the level of one that would result in our intervention, to share that information with an entity with whom we were contracting, and that entity would go out, find that family, knock on the door in the best service model that I have heard about. And I, in response to this case, you're not the only person who's been talking to us about the safety net program and what a loss it's been for communities. In some communities, the Commission on Children and Families actually were the contractors for that program, and they would work with their community partners. They would sometimes sit in our offices, and so there was almost no time lag between the handoff of a call having been received and the person kind of walking out the door. And in other communities, it was somebody that was not internal to didn't sit necessarily in our office, but that we would give the information to, and they would go out. We do still have a program which we call Family Support and Connections, which is the last remaining remnant of the Community Safety Net program. And what happened, if I recall correctly, I was able to watch the demise of this program, unfortunately.
Family Support and Connections.
Okay. When I was serving as the governor's health and human services advisor, and he was elected and came into office in 2003, that was really the first point in time that we saw the first reduction to what you're referring to, the safety net program. It got further reduced through 2005, but there was about $1.5 million, I can't recall now the exact amount, that was left, and there was some discussion deliberately by the legislature about where would that very small amount of money, which spread out across many counties doesn't result in much in the way of service, where would it make the biggest impact? And the conversation turned to our TANF program, because so many of we started to look at the data around the percentage of kids in foster care that had previously been on the TANF program within the last 2 months. At the time, it was around 24%. Today, it's closer to 30. So we targeted the resources to parents in the TANF program, who the TANF program now screens and says are most at risk of child welfare entry. So there is a bit of the work that used to go on through the safety net program still happening through the Family Supports and Connections program, but the model looks different. And under the model you're describing, it purchased two things. It purchased staffing, so the staff to go out and do the visits and coordinate the services, and it sometimes also purchased services for the families. And so we had a child safety work group that got together, was inclusive of the Commission on Children and Families. Children First for Oregon chaired the group. Our folks were at the table, many community partners, and they all recommended as one of their top 10 priorities a revival of the Community Safety Net program. And I think this case speaks to, many people have been talking to me about the fact that it would really benefit us as a state to think about that policy change and kind of going back to where we used to be.
I'd like to talk with you in Lane County sometime, Lois. Because I think this is very important, and maybe we can get something going but I don't know to what extent, but I would at least like to talk with you about if TANF is doing some of that, just what's going on. So.
Was there any contact from the educational community at all on reporting on this case?
Yeah, Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, one of our legal obligations is to keep confidential the identity of reporters.
I'll ask the question differently.
I'm sorry.
I'll ask differently. One of my passions is that at some point in looking at how we deliver services that we actually include our social workers right in the school building, because often inside of the school building, things occur that individuals see or learn and what have you that sometimes doesn't get to us, and I still have an interest in pursuing that avenue, and hopefully the agency will also, you know, continue to want to talk about that. So I won't ask you anymore. But that's but I do think that there is a place for the record. I do think there's a place, a very valuable place for us to look at how, given our limited resources and given where we are, and knowing that often there are situations that arise that I remember when I used to volunteer when my children were in school and I'd go, you would see things at school that you knew that the social work system could help. Or the caseworker could help, rather than waiting until things get much larger and bigger in context. So just something to think about in the future.
Chair Moore, oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish the thought.
Chair Moore, Set Center Winners, Lois was just writing me a note to remind me that 20% of all, overall, of all of our reports do come from the school system. But one of the things that I just, in this case, that I think is a systems issue is what happens when we are dealing with children who maybe are not in school, and that applies sometimes to our youngest children, preschool age. And in this case, it happened to apply to a young person who was older. And that's not what we're really trying to be very careful about is not to be expressing any opinion about public schooling or homeschooling or anything else. That's not what we're saying here. What we're saying, though, is that it's our system depends upon people like schools, like the medical community, like the faith community, who've been designated by law as mandatory reporters to let us know when they have concerns about children. And when we are not, when the only eyes and ears, when we have information that the only eyes and ears or interaction that a child's having is with their primary caregivers, we're asking ourselves whether there's more that we should do, because we wouldn't be getting information from those other very important people who most often are the ones who report to us when there are concerns about a child.
Well, thank you. That just supports my direction.
We are very supportive of your direction, Senator.
I'm just really glad that you are now looking at how many calls you receive and if there were some that weren't recorded. Because I know the system must get a lot of calls. I know how many calls I did that I didn't really have, since I was working with at-risk families, I wasn't really sure if there was something going on, but I just had a gut feeling, and so I would call and I would report what I would observe and say, I'm not sure, but, you know, how many calls like that do you get? I can understand where maybe the system would be overloaded. Do you have an Excel sheet or whatever? And
Chair Morissette, Senator Mons Anderson, in the past, we had a system where we documented every call we received, whether it was an allegation of abuse or neglect or not. And the system was quite overloaded with information on families that really wasn't appropriate for us to maintain. So we discontinued, I think it was in 2007. I'm sorry, I'm not totally certain of the date. We discontinued writing every single call down. And our screeners are trained to be asking questions that elicit information to tell us, is this a call related to abuse and neglect about a child who may be unsafe? That's what we document in our system. And calls that we don't document, which were not about abuse and neglect, we don't document them any longer, but we may make suggestions to the caller around other services that are available or other entities in the community they may want to contact. But a call such as the one you've just described, this is one of the reasons we have casework level staff in screening, is because when someone calls and says, I have this gut feeling, that is generally related to something they've seen or heard, and our job is to attempt to elicit from that caller what that was, that detail that's causing that sensation in their gut. Those calls we write down. Those calls are documented in our system. We may not go out to see the child because something mitigates the safety factor there, but they're documented and we call them closed at screening, and they're part of the record.
Okay, good.
So we are looking at the issue of age and how it influences our decision-making and whether it does in cases other than this one that are happening across the state. We are looking at the issue of isolation, and we'll be consulting with some medical professionals about how and what we may need to be doing differently if we have information about a child who's not in contact with traditional community supports. And this issue around screening and assessment, just worthy of note, I think, is that the state changed its practice model as recently as 07 and really fully implemented it in 2008. So that's a very recent change in the way that we do our work that asks us to do it much more comprehensively. And this center that we're consulting with is the same one that helped advise us on creation of that practice change. And as we've seen, our staff make some improvement but continue to struggle in terms of this area. We wanted them to come back out and really look at things like our staffing levels, our policy and expectations, and our overall approach to the new model, which is now the model, the Oregon Safety Model, and give us and kind of update the work that we've done around training and other things to make sure that we're doing everything we can to support staff in our to meet our expectations about the work on that front end, which is so important. I'm just going to quickly run through these things just to make sure that you all have plenty of other time to ask us questions, but if you don't mind me just sort of summarizing this really quickly. We do have a work plan for the year, and the work plan is focused on the goals that we talked about earlier. And what this page does is summarize for you some of the major areas of effort that we are undertaking in 2010. More in-home services, using existing resources. We're kind of doing some restructuring so that we can serve more families in their own homes and hopefully support the prevention of foster care entry. We're trying to do more. We totally rewrote our policy with respect to relatives, and I mentioned the National Resource Center. The relative piece really transcends almost all of these goals in many respects. We're doing some work on kids who've been in care a long time and really trying to look again more regularly at whether they need to continue to be in foster care or whether there is some other option we can move them toward, like adoption or guardianship or even reunification with their families. You should know that you have supported financially, and we thank you for this, a very significant overhaul, in fact, a complete overhaul of the information system that supports the work that child welfare does. That's called ORKIDS. It's replacing our SACWIS system and bringing us into compliance with federal expectations. But if any of you have ever undergone a major a change in the programming that you use to email or calendar, you can appreciate this is a very serious undertaking for our field structure this year, and we'll, on the other side, have some very positive consequences for us in terms of safety in foster care, tracking kids, looking at data, communicating data and information with our partners, but it will be a very big transition for us during the course of this year. We've got some very deliberate work happening around child welfare equity that we very much look forward to getting into more detail with you on at another time. And the foster care safety team work, again, a very deep body of work that is inclusive of many, many things. We would love to report back to you on if you have any interest in that. And the health, mental health issues you all have been very involved with us around in terms of wraparound, the redesign of our foster care rate structure, mental health assessment, timeliness, and psychotropic medications. I think that I mentioned the ORCIDS piece, but obviously our own infrastructure is really critical to us being able to do this work well. I mentioned transformation earlier and helping us streamline our business processes, and we continue to work with staff on how to strengthen their skills as they interact with families and how to define some very clear, consistent expectations and supports for supervisors. And as we look ahead, you know, I think we've talked already about some of the most significant challenges. So first and foremost, unfortunately, and you know, I know this conversation grows a bit weary sometimes, but it's my obligation, I really believe, in this position to say that we are under-resourced as a system, and I think as a state and each of you are very committed to children and families, and we've had many, many discussions about this, but the fact is that our system is one that no matter the resources we have, we serve the families that are in crisis and that need our services. And so as the number of those families grow, and our resources don't grow with that growth rate, and the need and the complexity of the casework keeps growing, it really puts a lot of pressure on our workers and our staff. And it's really hard. I spend time with our staff quite a bit, and it's very difficult when they know what it is that they need to do, and they just can't quite do it. And in this work, with so much at stake, we take that very seriously. And as I said, you know, as a management team, we're constantly looking for ways to minimize some of their workload issues so they can focus on the things that make the biggest difference for children and their families. Our system isn't the only one under-resourced. The courts don't have enough time to spend on our cases. Attorneys representing parents don't have enough time to spend with their clients. There aren't enough CASA workers. The list goes on and on. And it's just important work, and so I really feel the need to call those issues out. But we are moving forward, and we're trying to do so very deliberately and strategically. Community and family engagement is a key part of this. We will not be successful on our own, and we really believe that. We have the CASE partnership and a very strong partnership with the Commission on Children and Families around this work, and it's been very encouraging to see what can happen even with limited resources in that area. And we will continue to be committed to transparency and accountability for the work that we do, and that's really in large part what our system needs to be all about, so that you all can appreciate its complexity and the needs that we have, and we can work together to continue to improve. So I appreciate the time today very much.
Mr. Chair, quick question, Aaron. What percentage of your families that you're working with are unemployed and underemployed? Do you have that kind of data?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I don't have it in front of me, but we don't collect that particular data point, but we do know how many of our children are eligible for 4E, which is the federal support that is provided to states, primarily focused around foster care, substitute care, and I don't know. Did you just write me a note? Okay.
No, I
don't know exactly the percentage, but what I do know is that 4E criteria around income eligibility has been constant since 1996 when they set the criteria. So it's based off of a 1996, the AFDC welfare reform level, and it's never been updated. So we can take a look, and we could tell you the number of families that are meeting that criteria currently in the system, and that would give us a sense of the income level of some of our families. The other way to look at that, which is sometimes controversial to talk about, but it's very real, is that children who live in families that are in poverty are much more likely to be victims of maltreatment. And there are several reasons for that, whether it's parents' stress, inability to provide, and it's both abuse and neglect. And it's so there is a relationship between the income level of a family and the consequences for the child and that family and their child safety.
I came across some data the other day, and I hadn't. When we were still being able to harvest timber, and Oregon's income was 109% of the national average. In fact, we were above the national average, and now I think we're somewhere 90 or below. And so the earning power of families and jobs, I think has some direct correlation with, abuse and neglect and domestic violence and some of those other stressors that are placed on families. Thanks, Aaron.
The fractured family syndrome is part of the whole thing. Families disintegrate more easily today than they did years ago, and part of it is economic, but there are other causes, and the fact that families don't stay together has, that's something to do with it. I don't know how you deal with that.
Get rid of drugs.
Well, there are
drugs.
A lot of
educate everybody.
There are a lot of reasons for fractured families, and some of them people don't pay too much attention before they get married. There are a lot of marriages that just are not. I know, but the fractured family in some areas where they have extended families, there probably is less abuse. And I don't, the Latino families in other countries maybe, where there is a much larger group to take care of a child. And, mm-hmm. and now, in the nuclear family, and particularly if it's fractured, there are only a few eyes and ears around, where before mm-hmm. you had uncles and aunts and so on. So that, you know, our demographics and our mm-hmm. customs change and so on. So anyway, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Lois, we will be in touch.
Chair Moore said, I should tell you that I'm now working here in Salem. However, I can talk to you about the folks that are working there in Lane County, and I think they'd enjoy having a conversation.
Well, I'm still kind of interested in that the people who were working on the safety net, and Gloria Griffith, I don't know if you know mm-hmm. Gloria. I believe she was part of that, and so on and so forth. And
I'd enjoy having that conversation.
I just want to see if there's, you know, what's going on there.
Thank you.
Well, you look like